Thanks to everybody who have become Coast Insiders, because it's programs just like this one tonight with our first-time guest and author of Another 19, Kevin Ryan. You're going to want to replay this show a few times. Go and check it out. Oh, and by the way, a while ago I said we were talking about the fuel that exploded for when the airplanes crashed into the towers. And it's true, Jet A is closer to kerosene and diesel number one. I said number one farm diesel. In fact, while most modern diesel engines specify diesel number two, many diesel engines will run on Jet A. And in fact, some of those old Russian jets that people occasionally buy will actually run for a while and run well on number one farm diesel. It's just a matter of additive. So let's not get caught up in that thing about, is it the summertime blend or the wintertime blend? There are slight differences, but they're all related. Jet A, kerosene, and diesel, they are very, very closely related. Okay, just a little scientific fact there. And another thank you for becoming Coast Insiders. You make our day every time somebody signs up because you find value in the program. And that's good, because if you don't find value in the program, guess what? It won't be around very long. You get 3 years of archive shows. It's very inexpensive. It's a nice service. You'll enjoy it. And if you ever have any trouble of any kind, logging on or logging in or anything like that, and you got a problem, you're going, I'm mad, I want to get on it, I can't do it, just email Lex at Coast to Coast AM, and he'll have it sorted out for you in about 10 seconds, okay? We'll be right back with Kevin Ryan in just a moment. This is Coast to Coast AM. Kevin Ryan, it's really good to have you on the program tonight. It's a fascinating discussion tonight, and even though some of these elements have been discussed over and over again, you've put a different light on it. And it's this is such a comprehensive work. It's difficult to deny the veracity of it. How long did it take you to put this together? This looks like it's got to be a couple of 3 years.
Yeah, 4 years actually, John. And I began looking at the people who had access to the World Trade Center in early 2009. So it took me 4 years to accumulate the information, the research, and the last year and a half, I really focused on putting it together in a book.
Well, let's seg just for a moment over to the Pentagon. Now, just between ourselves, I've asked this question to John Lear. I ask it to Philip Marshall. Now, I can't explain this, but John Lear said, you know John Lear, he's flown, I don't know, 100 and something different types of aircraft. His dad, you know, invented all kinds of stuff. And, you know, he's a hell of an aviator. And he said, totally impossible to get that aircraft to that speed and for it to hit that building at that, right at that spot, at almost ground level at the Pentagon. Philip Marshall, on the other hand, said, I said, Philip, the hole in the wall is smaller than the diameter of the fuselage. And where is the indestructible landing gear? Where are the near indestructible engines? Where are the marks on the building? What do you make of that strike there? And then let's talk about Frank Probst.
Yeah. The Pentagon is a topic of lively discussion amongst those of us who are interested in 9/11 truth, that's for certain. You know, the exact story of what happened is still, I'd say, out of reach, but there's a lot to explain. As you said, this is a Boeing 757, and it engaged in what everyone who has seen the data has agreed was a miraculous dive, corkscrew dive over a period of thousands, over a distance of thousands of feet, and came out of that corkscrew dive going, according to the official account, 500 miles per hour and hitting the first floor of the Pentagon, you know, just at top speed.
I thought it was 500 knots, but it might be miles per hour. In any case, it was quite fast. And what a shot, right there, almost at ground level.
Yeah, the thing that drew me to this most strongly was that the plane hit a very small section of the building that had been the focus of a renovation plan. And I go into that in the book, basically asking the question, was this renovation project part of this attack? And I learned that the company that was hired to complete the renovation was called AMEC, A-M-E-C, was led by a man who was a close business partner of Donald Rumsfeld. His name was Peter Jansen. And not only were they hired for this $258 million renovation project in the exact small area where the plane hit, which had just been completed right before the attack, they were hired in a no-bid contract to clean up the mess, and then they were hired as the lead contractor to clean up the World Trade Center site as well. So they were in control of the evidence at the World Trade Center. They were the ones who constructed this impact zone. And I believe what happened, and I think a lot of people agree with me, is that there were explosives in the building. And I believe the explosives would explain to some extent what evidence you've mentioned, the size of the holes. It's not just the size of the holes and their ability to match up to the carbon-nosed Boeing jet, but the
perfectly
question,
round. Sorry.
Yeah, the question of how this jet could have punched through three rings of the Pentagon. Now, whether it was going 500 miles per hour or not, and you know, the question is how that carbon-nosed aircraft, aluminum fuselage aircraft, could have punched through. Now, people may say, well, maybe it was one of the engines, but then again, you've got a mismatch again, I think. But I talk about Frank Probst, as you said, because he was the main witness to this plane, close up to this plane impacting the building. And some interesting coincidences with him is he just happened to be checking the area where the plane hit in the few minutes before the attack. It turns out this guy was a lieutenant colonel, retired from the Defense Communications Agency. And now that's the agency that's in control of the satellites in the American airspace. And he's checking something right there at the point of impact. He goes off to a construction trailer, and they talk about these attacks occurring. And then he leaves the construction trailer, and the plane allegedly flies right over his head. I mean, couldn't it be just a matter of feet? Because the plane hit just 6 feet above the ground.
Yeah.
Now, one question with that is the wake, the turbulence that a Boeing 757 generates 6 feet away from the plane is known to be dramatic.
Pretty rough, yeah, especially if it's doing 500 miles an hour.
Yeah, so how this man lived to tell a story is one question. Then he told the story, And he talked about how he was just happened to be there, and he just happened to be talking about the attacks in the construction zone. But the plane hit that very construction entrance where they were working on it. And I go into a hypothesis. I make it clear that it's a hypothesis attempting to explain more of the unanswered questions, because we have not been successful in either fully explaining or agreeing upon what exactly happened at the Pentagon. But I talk about remote control and the technology available to control these aircraft, which was very well established on 9/11. In fact, exercises were being conducted in the months before 9/11 to utilize these technologies for guidance of a large airliner, really. They were very precise in their ability to control the aircraft, to bring it in the aircraft into a certain area. In fact, experts said that that planes could have been flown directly into the Oval Office back then if it was necessary. So I talk about this remote control technology and how the equipment for it, even going to the exact equipment that would be needed, how it would appear that it would have fit very well in these construction trailers, which were just outside the impact zone of the building, which is just where the plane hit. So I talk about that, and Frank Probst, as he said, and I go into a colleague of Probst, fellow West Point graduate Paul Mikar, who was hired to do the investigation of the building afterward, and how he had been accused years later of obstructing the Hurricane Katrina investigation, and how he was connected through family, through marriage, to a man who worked with Alan Dulles, the famous CIA director, and just, you know, the issues about him having conducted experiments on explosions at the Pentagon in the years before 9/11. And so all I try to do is explain more of the unanswered questions. You know, why did the plane hit that impact zone? How could it have possibly been flown, regardless of what kind of plane it was? I mean, it might have been a large plane of another type, but most of the witnesses do talk about a large aircraft hitting the building, and it did appear to be flown like a guided missile. So those are some of the things that I go into.
Well, you know, and what happens the moment that somebody is out there fooling around in their little Cessna, and they start going into restricted airspace? I'll tell you what happens. A jet shows up right next to you going, you better wiggle your wings and let us know that you're going to do exactly what we tell you. And you couldn't fly into restricted airspace. I mean, around the Pentagon and the Capitol and so forth. You couldn't get anywhere near that place without having a jet on you. Before 9/11, they'd send something up there real quick. They got nothing to do all day except sit on the tarmac and wait to be scrambled. They live for that.
Absolutely. That area that you're mentioning over Washington, D.C. is the most highly secure airspace in the country. It's got a special code, P-56 is the area. And I talk about in an earlier chapter on NORAD, the failure of the planes to the interceptor jets to intercept the hijacked aircraft. But they did this routinely every year, 129 year times in the year before, and yet they couldn't catch up to any of the four hijacked airliners on 9/11, none of which squawked the hijack code. That means put in their transponder that they were being hijacked. None of them did that, almost as if they were using technology that day that was available and was patented just after 9/11 to take control of a hijacked aircraft and shut down its communications and just do whatever it is that the remote pilot might want to do with the plane.
That sounds a lot more plausible than some guys getting some simulator training and then being able to place those aircraft right where they placed them. Marshall said, and he was a United pilot, he just said, look, and Lear said it too, he goes, they both said, we're skilled pilots. I mean, they didn't say that. They said, I'm a skilled pilot. It would be a real problem for me to get in an aircraft like this, take over, and then put them right on target. No problem at all. That would be an enormous task for even the most seasoned pilot. These guys had no trouble with it whatsoever. So, you know, I think that anytime we hear about technology like Michael Hastings' car, he was suspicious of his rented Mercedes and he thought it had been hacked. And there appears to be ample evidence indicating that his computer system was hacked. These couple of guys, I can't remember what university they were at now. But they said, look, we'll take this laptop, we'll plug it in. Well, if you can do it by plugging it in, you can do it by Bluetooth, you can do it by probably some other methods that we don't even know about. You know, certain cars have had black boxes built into them for years. Well, we're just now starting to hear about that. So I have no doubt that the technology that we hear about has been operational for a good length of time before anybody got a whiff of it.
Yeah, I think you're right, John. The Pentagon is still a work in progress in terms of answering the questions, but I believe that remote control technology, which was available at the time, had a part in it, and I also believe the renovation project that was connected to Donald Rumsfeld's fellow director, Peter Jansen, had a part in it as well.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you, the old rabbit hole, this is not a rabbit hole. This is more an elephant hole or something. It's just, it's ridiculous. Going over to this is going to be chapter 11. Brian Michael Jenkins says, terrorism is theater.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we've got a lot of mileage out of that. You know, Adolf Hitler was very fond of terrorism. He said, oh, yeah, you know, that's the one right there, because the thought of being annihilated just without warning, that really gets the public's attention. We can get a lot of mileage out of this.
Yeah, people seem to be compelled to do any number of things in order to make themselves and their family safe. And that's reasonable to some extent, unless they're being given information that's clearly false, like the official reports on the attacks of 9/11. When I talk about Brian Michael Jenkins, I talk about his history as a special operations soldier, and several people in the book were connected to special operations, but also his history as being a right-wing advisor for Reagan in conducting a terror war in Central America in the 1980s, and how that seems startling, given that he worked as deputy chairman for Kroll Associates, a company that designed the World Trade Center security system after the 1993 bombing. And Jenkins not only designed that World Trade Center security system, but he did consider exactly the things that happened on 9/11. And, he and his partner, L. Paul Bremer, who's also covered in that chapter, were very interesting characters, given that they led the nation in being experts on counterterrorism. And they created, in large part, the myth of Al-Qaeda terrorism from the existing Soviet threat of terrorism. And there were, I talk about the commissions they were on and how that evolved, how the Cold War threat, which kind of died out, unfortunately, as the Soviet Union collapsed for them. It was unfortunate, and they were terrorist experts, and then that was transformed into a threat of Islamic terrorism throughout the 1990s. And Jenkins and Bremer were leading characters in that, and they both played very interesting roles with regard to aviation security, and were both connected to the World Trade Center in important ways.
You know, Kevin, one of the sickest possibilities that I can think of at this moment is that while there might have been some militancy from the Islamic world, it seems that we've done everything that we can possibly do to ensure that there would be high levels of militancy toward us from the Muslim world.
Right.
It's almost as though we deliberately jacked them up and continued to, until it's like, okay, now we got them mad. Now we've got an enemy. It's almost as though we created an enemy. Am I just completely out to lunch on this? And if I am, just say so. I can take it.
No, I think there's a little bit of truth to both, but there has been a concerted effort to control the narrative. And I believe that's connected to, an effort to co-opt terrorism and promote it and exacerbate it in the ways that you have described.
Well, you know, we got a terror war is starting to blossom. Well, it's starting to bloom. It hasn't quite completely blossomed yet, but we've got that going on in Africa now, in sub-Saharan Africa. And the Chinese are starting to move in a little bit more there. You never can tell. Your friends are your enemies, and your enemies are your friends. Who knows? Well, let's take our little break. It's been a quick couple of hours and a half, but we still have more with first-time guest Kevin Robert Ryan. Go to his website, Another 19, and use the number 19 in the title, another19.com, and come back quick. This is Coast to Coast AM. That's pretty much what we have to do, unenlightened. But we will be as we go on. We just need to keep on sailing. Just sail on through it. Tell you what, when we come back, golly, what a quick night. Just like the month of August seemed like it blew by. In fact, the whole summer just blew by. talking with Kevin Ryan tonight. We want to explore the money aspect when we come back, because there were some little bit of monkey business, maybe some shares being shorted, stuff like that, just prior to the attacks. Maybe some money that was lying around that has yet to be picked up. And don't you find that even though and it's documented in this this excellent book, Another 19 by Kevin Ryan, that as of the mid-90s, it was just generally accepted that the whole Gulf of Tonkin fiasco was a fraud and a false flag, which pulled us into the Vietnam War. So, and we were there for what, they call it the 10,000-day war or something? I haven't done the math on it, but it certainly felt like 10,000 days if it was not. It's September. Happy September, everybody. It's September 1. And guess what? Next Sunday is the second Sunday of the month. So it'll be next weekend. It's going to be you and me for three, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And there are some amazing programs scheduled for you. Feel certain that you will enjoy them. Who are they? Who are they? Oh, you'll find out. And you'll go, what? And you will like it. So stand by. We still have some more time with Kevin Ryan tonight, and we're going to get to it just as soon as we do this thing that we have to do on Coast to Coast AM. Kevin Ryan, you know, earlier tonight I was reading a little news story off the Coast to Coast AM .com website about the two fellows that got together, and one of them's hand began to move across on the other side of the campus because of a thought of his partner on the far side, and they're connected electronically and so forth. So, you know, so many people, I mean, I've absolutely heard it all. I'm sure you have too. It's like everything from no planes hit the towers to holograms hit were used to deceive everybody. And it was a particle beam weapon, some sort of energy weapon. It's unbelievable. Some people can show them, look, here's the fabric. It's red. And they go, no, it's not. And it's either because they're colorblind or they're just stubborn. But there are too many things all coming together, everything from the people who were involved, a few of which we've covered. It would take us a 20-hour interview to thoroughly discuss your work. And I recommend that. I really recommend. Books are great. I mean, I like e-books. I like that stuff. But there's nothing like having a book you can hold in your hand. Just take a little side trip here. To obtain your book, we would go where? Amazon, the usual places, or your website, or where?
Yeah, Amazon. That's right.
Okay. All right, very good. So in the end, there's the money factor. And let's see, I'm over here to, where am I? Yes, I'm on chapter 12. And the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission referred specific instructions or transactions, rather, to the FBI for criminal investigation. Whatever became of that? How much money was involved?
Well, the issue of insider trading on 9/11 involves a great deal of money, and it also involves more than one financial vehicle. You know, we're talking about stock trades like those on the airlines that were impacted on 9/11, or the exact companies that were in the World Trade Center towers. We're talking about treasury bonds at a higher level. We're talking about credit card transactions that mysterious credit card transactions that occurred that morning on the computers in the buildings, and how those computer hard drives were recovered over time and restored by companies that said that they reflected what they called doomsday dealings, so transfer of large amounts of money. But insider trading in this chapter points to a man named Wirt Walker, who was the CEO for a company called Stratesec. So we talked about the design of the World Trade Center security system by Kroll Associates and Brian Jenkins, but that design was implemented by Stratesec. People may have heard of this company because on the board was George W. Bush's brother, Marvin, and the CEO was this man, Wirt Walker. And the SEC flagged some trades that Walker and his wife did on Stratesec stock. And it was not very evident at first, but the 9/11 Commission released documents, and then it was revealed that it was Wirt Walker and his wife that were involved. So the 9/11 insider trading, I actually wrote a chapter of a book for Jesse Ventura. He's got a book called 63 Documents the Government Doesn't Want You to Read. And documents 48 and 49 are from me regarding the 9/11 insider trading issue. And but there are other really important reasons why Wirt Walker and his companies should just jump right out to people. Stratesec, Marvin Bush, of course, the other directors of Stratesec, including the guy I wrote about in the next chapter, Barry McDaniel, and his connections to Iran-Contra, and the fact that all of this was owned by a Kuwaiti company. Now, if people don't know, you know, Ramzi Youssef, who was convicted of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, was a Kuwaiti. So right after that, then, for some reason, the World Trade Center security implementation was led by a company owned by Kuwaitis. Now, that was seen as just unprecedented that a foreign company of any kind would have security contracts for the World Trade Center and Dulles Airport in Washington. You know, but
unbelievable.
Yeah, it really is. And so I go into in these chapters Stratesec and the Kuwaiti parent company and a little bit of 9/11 insider trading. But if you really want the story on that, my more detailed work is in Jesse Ventura's book.
Okay. Doomsday dealings, they already had a term for it?
Well, yeah, this company, Convar, a German company, they recovered the hard drives from the computers that were engaged in these massive transactions of funds. And they showed that someone was involved with stealing large amounts of money on the morning of 9/11 through these computers. But you know, you mentioned that some of the money wasn't even on the stock trades, wasn't even claimed afterwards. There was millions of dollars in stock trades that were done before 9/11, and If people wonder, there's really not a lot of question about it anymore, because several international teams of experts at universities around the world have proven statistically that these were insider trades with foreknowledge of the events of 9/11. And so, you know, given that, the fact that they were not investigated either by the FBI or the 9/11 Commission, and what I mean by that is that the people who were named were not even interviewed, and they were just said to have no connections to Al-Qaeda. As I go into my book, Wirt Walker does have some interesting connections to Al-Qaeda, and it's clear that the 9/11 Commission and the FBI did not do their jobs with regard to this investigation.
Or maybe they were blocked from it.
It's possible.
You know, what about Giuliani? Some of his comments that were caught on tape were a little odd as he was strolling through the rubble. Oh, I always liked Rudy, but it's he was not cast in the best light in some of these segments.
Right. And, you know, with him, it's clear that he had been given information that the buildings would collapse when none of the fire chiefs at the site or anywhere else would have predicted these buildings, which were designed for just this sort of thing and had been, as we talked about, certified for fire resistance. None of the fire chiefs thought these buildings would fall at all, let alone at free fall acceleration. But somehow Giuliani was given the information that they would. Now, Giuliani also has connections to BCCI, which we talked about before, the terrorist financing network. He led the enforcement actions against BCCI, and then he went to work for a law firm that represented BCCI. These things really need to be followed up, given his leading role at the site of the World Trade Center attack and his political gain, enormous political gain, from having been seen as the hero of 9/11.
You know, have I missed something here? Well, I don't see any mention. Another conspiracy component to the overall theories of what may have happened on that day involved the Israelis and Mossad agents dancing around the van, yeah, excitedly laughing and to talk about the event and so forth. Do you have anything on that?
Yeah,
as we'll cover it.
I talk about the dancing Israelis and how that indicated they were discovered to be Mossad agents.
Okay, so it's a real deal. That's not an urban legend. That's a fact.
No, these people were filming the event as it was occurring. They were arrested. They were kept in jail for 73 days. And later, on television in Israel, they admitted they were there to film the event. They were intelligence operatives. Now, I do go into that in the book. And so one point I make is that, if Israel or elements of the Israeli government were involved, which would not be surprising given that they benefited from the attacks, then I believe that we need to still focus on the people who were in position to make things happen. So if there were, for example, Douglas Feith, who was a leading advisor to Paul Wolfowitz. Paul Wolfowitz is one of the suspects in the book. He has strong connections in support of Israel, but his assistant, Douglas Feith, has even stronger connections and worked in the Pentagon as well. If it can be revealed more in detail what they specifically did, that's what we need to learn in terms of whether or not they were representing Israel in the attacks. It's possible. And as I said, we need to keep open minds about all of this. Israel is basically a protected, and we basically, our military oftentimes seems to be working for Israel. And so those questions are legitimate, and whether or not Israeli agents were involved, I think, needs to be more fully revealed, and also specifically what they did to accomplish the attack. So I go into the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait as being foreign governments that need to be investigated, Israel as a possibility. But when we talk about who specifically, we need to say what they did. And the Mossad is defined basically by the word deception. So, keep in mind that it's not going to be readily apparent. It could be some of these 19 suspects were Mossad operatives. It's not going to be readily apparent given their modus operandi who is or is not a Mossad agent.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a tough crew. They really are. And they got very long arms. They can reach out and touch just about anybody they feel the need to. As we get close to the end of our time together tonight, we did not cover everybody because, we only had 3 hours. But you've written here that most of the suspects reviewed were shown to have benefited from the 9/11 attacks through promotions or political or business gains. But there's an intangible benefit to consider as well. Many of them were players in the last war in which the United States was defeated.
Yeah.
That's a strange angle.
It is. It just seemed to continue to crop up. The people who were in position to make 9/11 happen as it did, many of them were special operations specialists. Many of them were combat veterans like Frank Probst from Vietnam. And special operations veterans, Dick and Don, basically were in the White House at the time of Vietnam. And many of the other people, Bremer and Richard Clark and Wolfowitz, were in government at that time as well. And they were the hawks, basically. They were the ones promoting the Vietnam War, defending the actions of Nixon and Ford. And they, it's clear that they were really decimated by the defeat. I mean, there's an author, Kevin Phillips, who wrote a book, and he said basically Vietnam was the seed of the Iraq War. It was the lingering, emotional driver for some people to conduct wars that they knew they could win, that they would never be defeated again. And, Dick and Don and a lot of these characters appear to have been among those who were along what Kevin Phillips said, looking for ways to be heroes again.
I just don't know where, I don't know what to make of this. It's, from the perspective of the citizen, is it a strategic objective of one kind or another, either the power that you spoke of earlier, just power for power's sake? Is it enrichment? Is it hubris? Is it just some people just don't mind sitting there watching the world burn? I mean, I suppose all of those are possibilities. After all, once you strip away the titles of office and everything else, they're just human beings like everybody else. Some would argue that they're actually reptilians with human, really realistic human suits stretched over them. But for the moment, we'll go with them all being human beings. It's just difficult to predict what their next move will be. Other than the obvious, the Syrian problem here, as you look at this, and then, of course, I'm sure you keep up with the current events as well. What do you see as the next, or do you see a bright blip on the screen other than Syria, which I think is going to, I personally don't think it's going to morph into World War III. I think it's just going to kind of peter out and go away, and everybody will get over it, and we'll reset and see if we can set up something else a little bit more cleverly next time.
Yeah, I think that as far as bright blips, things to look out for, maybe not positive things. I think the efforts of the National Security Agency to spy on all Americans and the lack of outrage, in my opinion, that is occurring is something to continue to watch because, it's been revealed by the whistleblower Snowden that the NSA is collecting emails, phone messages, everything, if only metadata, some part of it, on all Americans. There's a database now of all communications. The other thing that I recently wrote an article on was what I call drone terror. The use of these drone aircraft to fight battles, undeclared wars around the world. The United States is bombing with drones half a dozen countries as we speak, and most of them we have not declared war against. More importantly, there are 30,000 plus drones being manufactured for use within the United States, according to reports. And those are things we need to watch. We need to think about how we can live with those things if they're not going to be removed, if they're not going to be backtracked. How can we live with the fact that drones will be in our environment and all of our communications are being watched? And are we going to have the courage to continue to speak out and ask for facts and truth that will lead us more to justice and some lasting positive change? I think that's what we need to continue to do. So hopefully people do have the spirit to do that in our country.
It was excellent to have you on the program tonight, Kevin. Really, really good. And I hope everybody will pick up a copy of Another 19 by Kevin Robert Ryan. You can get it on Amazon. I'm going to check in with you from time to time just to make sure everything's okay, all right?
Yeah, thank you, John, and thanks to everybody at Coast to Coast.
Well, you're welcome. It was a pleasure to have you on the program. Well, there you have it. I don't mind being the authority when I can masquerade as one. I don't mind playing the newbie either. We will talk to you on Friday next, Saturday next, and Sunday as well. And remember, wasn't it Voltaire who said, uncertainty is not pleasant, but certainty is absurdity. Voltaire, the French, they have such a good way of putting these things, yes. It's been a pleasure to be with you tonight. For everybody at Coast to Coast AM, have a very, very pleasant, long, and above all, safe Liberty weekend. Don't labor too hard. And when you come back on Tuesday, I have an idea. Patricia says, it's showtime. Why don't you just take a minute and call your elected official, if you know who they are, and tell them, we don't think it's a good idea for you to sanction another military action, so knock it off now or I'll vote you right out, me and everybody else. Good night, and be well.